This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine, where a portion of this interview will appear in print. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 41st in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm super pleased to have with me Fred Schneider. Hi, Fred.
Hi, Gary.
Fred Schneider is the Samuel B. Eckert Professor of Computer Science at Cornell University and Chief Scientist at the University Trust NSF-funded Science and Technology Center. Fred is an Associate Editor-in-Chief for IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine, who co-sponsors this podcast. Fred was editor of the National Academy study Trust in Cyberspace, published in 1998. And Fred is a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Science and the ACM, as well as a senior member of the IEEE. He holds a PhD from Stony Brook University and a DSC from University of Newcastle upon Tyne. Fred lives in Ithaca, New York, where he attempts to sail his boat from time to time. So off we go. Over the years, your work has focused on building distributed and concurrent systems for mission-critical, high-integrity settings. What is the relationship between security and reliability?
They're really quite closely tied. Both of them are excuses for the system not to do what you want, and the difference is what the cause was. The reliability concern typically is about random events that one can attribute to nature, whether it's physical processes or the fact that people aren't very good at thinking about large systems and they make programming errors. And security problems typically can be attributed to malevolence, where somebody is deliberately trying to undermine the system, but in a way that either prevents the system from behaving as it should or prevents you from getting your work done. My own trajectory into security is kind of amusing. I actually wanted to do a doctoral dissertation in computer security, and I went to a graduate department where somebody was working on it, and this person left before I got to the point where I was doing a dissertation. So I ended up working on what was at hand. That led me, and that was concurrent programming, and concurrent programs were most interesting when they were split across multiple machines in those days. And that led me to start thinking about how to program distributed computers. And the first thing you realize when you think about distributed computers is you have to deal with the fact that some of them may fail. Very few people had been worried about fault tolerance in those days. People who were building computers to fly airplanes weren't yet on the scene, and so there were some people who were worried about process control. Computer science kind of got caught up, and fault-tolerant distributed computing became a big deal, and that made sense because the dominant cause of difficulty was these failures. The internet wasn't around. There was the ARPANET, but the people on the ARPANET are all pretty friendly, and although in theory attackers existed, this was not a big problem for people getting their work done. The security concern existed partly in the Department of Defense and partly with people wanting to make sure that when they ran their program on a time-sharing system, somebody else's program didn't accidentally misbehave. It's only when the internet started to grow that there was a value proposition for making attacks. Once we became dependent on the internet, there were goods and services that one could disrupt or co-opt. And now, one had to worry about people trying to break systems by making security attacks. And so, whereas I originally was interested in reliability because that's where the problems were over the last decade or so, it turns out that our day-to-day computing activities are affected by security because that's where the problems are. Mm-hmm. And so I've kind of migrated with the demand.
I think that makes perfect sense. There are some people who claim that if we had a perfectly reliable system that it would necessarily be secure. I assume, based on your remarks, that you don't really believe that.
So I don't agree with that statement, and I actually have a scientific basis for disagreeing. When you build a reliable system, if you look carefully, what you typically do is you do some form of replication. A simple way to replicate a system is to have multiple components running in parallel, mm-hmm. and they all do the same thing, and maybe you vote on the output. There are fancier ways to package that. Instead of having multiple messages in parallel, if you add a checksum to one message, that's the equivalent of sending the message twice. And let's ignore those optimizations for a moment. But fundamentally, reliability is obtained by doing replication, and there's an assumption made, which is the replicas fail independently.
Mm-hmm.
And if you replicate things, then the probability that the majority of them fail is the probability that any single will fail raised to the nth power, where m is the number of boxes in the majority. And if p is less than 1, that actually improves things. That formula only makes sense if the failures are independent. So the assumption is if one box fails, it's not going to be at the same time as another box fails. So if, for example, all the boxes are plugged into the same power source and you blow a fuse, then all the boxes will fail and there's a single event, and that formula which says replication helps actually isn't any longer sound.
Mm-hmm.
So if separate boxes, then replication is a good thing and it gets you a better system than running a single system by itself. But if you replicate a system and the system you replicate had some vulnerabilities in it and therefore was subject to attack, then all replicas are subject to the same attacks. So you haven't made the system any more reliable. In fact, all you've done is given more places for the attacker to exercise his or her prowess. So the independence assumption that most fault tolerance people use, and often implicitly, is not valid if you're worried about building attack-resistant systems.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why security is really a different set of assumptions, and change the assumptions and you're likely to get a different set of solutions.
That's pretty interesting. I was going to ask you this later, but I think it's worth asking now based on what you said. You've been a vocal proponent of diversity, you know, viz your paper in the January-February issue of S&P called The Monoculture Risk Put Into Context. And you've talked about diversity as a useful thing out there. If diversity amounts to building independence from a failure perspective under attack, then we get right back around to the fault tolerance stuff, I suppose.
Right. So if we somehow were able to build diverse systems from the ground up, then that should increase the chances of building reliable systems, because if you believe in independence, then it's not likely that there'll be an event that takes all of them out. And if you believe that attacks depend on details of the systems, no single attack is likely to take all of them out also.
Mm-hmm.
But the kinds of artificial diversity people are using and are practical are not completely independent. Typically, you take the same program and you might generate different code for it, say by randomizing the storage layout or using different compilers or using different instruction sets.
Mm-hmm.
There, although the low-level stuff is somewhat diverse, the high-level stuff isn't. That is to say, all the replicas implement the same interface. So if this is a program that has an interface which probably isn't called gives me the keys to the kingdom, but has that effect,
mm-hmm.
then replicating it in diverse ways doesn't help, because an attacker who understands how to invoke this routine, give me the keys to the kingdom, ends up with the keys to the kingdom, and that's not what you want to happen.
Right, so that's sort of the level of defect, and it reminds me, I guess, of John Knight's attack on the inversion systems.
Right, so what the challenge that we have is, how do we build secure code? You and other people have focused quite extensively on writing secure code. Those stupid things programmers can do that makes it easy for an attacker to get in.
Mm-hmm.
And it, frankly, I'm mind-boggled at all the clever ways you can break badly written C code. We're now at a point, I believe, where code security is a well-understood problem. It's not a solved problem in the sense that programmers don't write secure code, but we have the tools around mental and developmental to confront the problem. Right? If people stopped writing in C, if we outlawed that, we'd go very far towards a solution. We don't have a prayer of understanding at the moment how to design stuff at a higher level, how to pick good interfaces and know with some confidence that some combination of those interfaces couldn't be invoked by a clever attacker in the right order and get some behavior that nobody anticipated. So that's going to be the next big problem we need to confront, at least those of us in the research business, hoping that those people who are actually building software will learn the lessons we have of common vulnerabilities and tools that eliminate them.
So I want to follow that line of thinking just a little bit more. I heard you express this continuum of attacks and expected attacks in terms of large swaths of targets moving from configuration errors first, then to bugs, which are implementation defects we've just described, then to flaws, which is my terminology for architectural defects, and then to trust problems. So you believe that we're making some good progress on the bugs problem. We've already made some progress in the past on configuration problems. And so the age of bugs is beginning to draw to a close. Is that the gist of it?
Well, it depends on what telescope you're using. If you're in the research business, which is where I sit, the age of bugs is over. Spending a lot of energy in figuring out how to fix bugs is not likely to get you famous or have an impact. If you're in the system building business, the age of bugs isn't over because there's lots of systems out there that don't practice the lessons we've taught, and people are still building systems the old way. So there's this huge incentive problem that needs to be addressed, and the incentive problem would cause people to practice what we have preached. If you're in the research business, then what you term flaws or these architectural problems are the gold mine, in the sense that there are lots of opportunities to make progress and give insights. The other piece of the picture that this taxonomy attacks brings has to do with a tactical issue. If we're in the business of trying to anticipate where attackers go, then this taxonomy gives you a basis for deciding where to make investments for future research so that you will have defenses in place before the attackers have an incentive to try to address that class of flaws. As long as there's low-hanging fruit, the attackers aren't going to go for anything higher. As we understand how to get rid of that low-hanging fruit, like, for example, the common desktop initiative in the federal government, which says everybody buys the same machine, the same software, and it comes configured by somebody who knows what they're doing, and therefore there are fewer configuration flaws. Well, do that, and all of a sudden the attackers have to worry about code security. So if we keep forcing the attackers down the path, then we would be wise to have positioned ourselves for the next step of the path before we force the attacker there. And this taxonomy then gives you some insight into the kinds of questions people ought to be thinking about now in anticipation of dealing with attacks in 5 or 10 years.
I think that's a beautiful line of thinking. We'll be right back after this message. Hi, this is Gary McGraw, host of the Reality Check podcast with Gary McGraw. This podcast series is focused on practical questions centered on running large-scale software security initiatives. Reality Check targets experienced leaders working to solve software security problems every day. Reality Check is sponsored by Sigital and syndicated by CSO Magazine. For more, see www.sigital.com/realitycheck. I'd like to know a little bit more about the thing past flaws, that is, what you've termed trust problems. Do you have a few words to say about that?
So trust problems, as far as I'm concerned, are the hardest ones. A trust problem is when, for various reasons, we structure our systems in terms of enclaves, where the definition of an enclave is that systems within an enclave have stronger basis of trust than systems outside the enclave. And this usually corresponds to organizational boundaries. I trust the file server in my building more than I trust the file server out the other end of the internet that's run by some other organization. What happens is, once you trust local machines or machines within your enclave, if any one of those machines gets compromised, it becomes a launching pad for an attacker to get to any of the other machines. Mm-hmm. And rather than getting in by breaking in, the attacker can get in just by asking for legitimate things, because after all, it's a legitimate request. It came from something that was trusted. So this kind of attack only is addressed if you become paranoid. That is to say, because someone's trusted doesn't mean they get to ask for anything they want.
Mm-hmm.
And that puts us into the realm of building systems, say, with least privilege. We don't know how to do that. And what we do know is if you have least privilege, it means you've got a lot of privileges around because you want to do everything slightly differently.
Mm-hmm.
Read, write, execute, not just at the level of a file, but maybe at the level of a record or a field, not just at the level of a module, but maybe at the level of an entry point.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an enormous bookkeeping problem. We know now that people, security officers and others, have trouble managing even the access control lists associated with files. Role-based access control is partway towards a solution, but even that is hard for some people to manage.
Especially with tens of thousands of actors. You know.
That's right. And if we now make each actor have to be associated with 10,000 different bits rather than the number of files in the file system number bits, we have a problem. So this is going to be a huge management problem, and either we'll devise suitable abstractions or we'll devise automatic ways to do this kind of thing, but there's a whole lot of understanding of how to build least privileged systems that needs to get sorted out before we can make progress on the trust problem. The insider attack problem is a trust problem,
mm-hmm.
by the way.
I've heard you use the term accountability when talking about this trust issue and what's to come. Do you want to explain your notion of accountability and how that can help us construct more secure systems?
Yes, certainly. So for the early part of my career, which was way back when I was worried about concurrent and distributed systems and I used to build formal proofs for the algorithms I designed, I would have argued that the way to solve all these problems is to make sure the systems we build are correct, and proofs were a good way to help with that. And this was, in effect, a doctrine of prevention. If the system has no flaws, it can't be attacked. The way to make sure it has no flaws is to prove that it does what it's supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
And we now know that those proofs are hard to construct, and it's even harder to write down a specification. So prevention is a risky proposition if you want to bet your life on it. The next step that I see beyond the doctrine of prevention is a doctrine of accountability. And it's a next step for software, but it's certainly not a next step in the real world. Everybody knows that our law enforcement system is based on figuring out who did the crime and catching them and convicting them. So that's not about prevention. That's about making people accountable for their actions. And to some extent, maybe it dissuades people from doing antisocial things. And to some extent, it takes people who insist social things and puts them in some isolated setting that makes it hard for them to do it. But what we're doing is we're making sure we can figure out who to attribute actions to, and based on that, they suffer the consequences. If we were to build systems based on accountability, then we would know what actions could be attributed to each of the principals, and in some cases, the principal is a person, and we might be able to then, when there's a denial of service attack, go after the person who started that.
Mm-hmm.
That's the theory. Now let's get practical about it. The first thing is many people misinterpret this to be every packet has to have the name of a person on it, and when a packet is a bad packet, it's an attack, then we go lock up the person whose name is on the packet. So we know already that a compromised system might issue packets on behalf of one person, even though it was compromised by somebody else. That's this big problem we have with botnets. Second, if you look carefully, the attribution information could be coarser or finer grained depending on what the need is. If you're worried about managing a network, what you need to know is what machines the packets are coming from, because if you're watching a denial service storm, you want to turn it off. You don't actually need to know who caused them to be sent. So for situational awareness and managing a network, you need a fairly non-personal form of attribution. If you're doing authorization and you want to look at a packet and you decide the packet can instigate an action or not based on where it comes from, that may come from a person, but it also might come from a service running on a machine that is known to be authorized or not authorized to take an action. So again, that's an example where the packet need not be trackable back to a person. It might suffice for the purpose for trackable back to a piece of program running somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, if you're trying to do forensics and you discovered a packet was involved in a crime, then you might want to trace it back to a person. So accountability is a way for you to understand where packets or the initiation of operations originate, but it can be done in a way that it's not necessarily tied to people. Usually in security, we associate principals with actors, principal, P-A-L, mm-hmm. and the actor doesn't have to be a person, and a nuanced view of accountability needs to take this into account and come up with a way for us to have the minimum amount of, say, personal information associated with these initiators of actions so we could get some desirable goal, whether it's controlling the system or doing forensics or doing authorization or any number of other things.
Sounds to me like the age of bugs is a little easier to deal with.
Yes, the bugs are going to be easier to deal with. We'll look back on them fondly.
We'll think C is good again. So you've been very much involved in commercial endeavors in computer security as well as your academic endeavors, including work with Cigital's TAB and Microsoft's Trustworthy Computing Academic Advisory Board and Fortify's TAB. What influence have you had on the state of the practice in the commercial world?
So the agreement usually when you get involved in one of these things is that you won't air their dirty laundry
right.
in public. And that makes it hard for me to give concrete examples of where I've said something and it's caused somebody's product line to
change. Why don't we zoom up several jillion levels to the notion of academia influencing commercial endeavors in the right way?
Right. So there certainly are various examples of academic protocols ending up in commercial deployment. Some of the work that's done in Microsoft for analyzing I/O drivers to make sure that they won't lead to blue screens is based on model checking work that had its origins in academics.
Mm-hmm.
If you use Kerberos for authentication, that had its origins in a Needham-Schroeder authentication protocol, but the first Kerberos actually was built as a project at MIT.
Mm-hmm.
The StackGuard scheme that the C compiler, one of the C compilers uses and is fairly widely used, is something Crispin Cowan did
mm-hmm.
when he was at a university. So university stuff does end up getting out. I think more importantly, at least for big companies, is if you get the right people in the room, you get a set of perspectives that's broader than simply a technical one.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I find particularly instructive about the Microsoft board is the board has roughly half computer scientists and half law professors on it. And we decided early on that we wouldn't run the board in terms of two halves. We wouldn't split the agenda and expect only half people come to the privacy discussions and only half the people to come to the technology discussions. Everybody sat through everything. The result is that computer scientists know a lot about privacy. The privacy folks know a lot more about technology. But many of the discussions get informed by both sides. And that is an important kind of synergy for a company that's worrying not only about low-level technical details, but big picture questions like, what's the best way to deploy this and decrease risk to our consumers? Because consumers actually don't make a big distinction between a legal problem of privacy and a technical problem of privacy. If they lose it, they lose it. And there are different aesthetics associated with thinking about things in terms of legal anticipating or thinking of things in terms of technological problems. So the Microsoft board has been actually very educational for me, and my general going in position for these boards is that as a professor, it's easy to do research, but it's not so easy to do research that's going to have an impact on real problems. And you can't learn about real problems by sitting on a university campus as easily as if you come into contact with people who are seeing them on the front lines. So my work with Cigital gave me a lot of insight into software development practices and developers who are worried about system design and data and design practices. The work with Fortify has given me an interesting perspective on how people use these sophisticated tools to do program analysis. I know about program analysis, but there's a big difference between knowing the theory of determining whether information flows from one variable to another and knowing the reality of dealing with 10,000 warnings when you run your tool on a big system, and how do you convey the information to the programmer in a way that the programmer will focus on the right things and
not
get
just
a sense of
throw the tool away.
Right, and the Microsoft experience has given me a much bigger picture about some of the privacy stuff. And in fact, Deirdre Mulligan, who co-chairs the TCAB with me for Microsoft and is a lawyer, and I are in the midst of trying to sort out what would be a legal theory that would make sense to try to promote or incentivize people to deploy the technologies that are being developed.
Yeah, Deirdre.
You know, we don't build systems that use everything we that use very much of what we know about defenses, and that's not the technologist's problem. I mean, they keep inventing these cool ideas, nobody uses them. And it's not because their cool ideas aren't cool or usable. It's because there's not an incentive structure in place. And that's a quest. That's a legal design question. And if you have experience with different legal theories, then you can start thinking about ways to change the legal system so that companies would be incentivized to use these technologies.
Deirdre gave a talk about that at USENIX in Montreal last week.
That was our co-authored paper, right?
That was pretty clear when she gave her talk. I think, you know, it certainly touches on economics as much as legal constraints as well.
Right. It's economics. It's policy in a general sense. It's law. It's regulation. It's setting up cultural expectations. It's education. It's a fairly broad area.
So I was going to ask you whether you believed the commercial enterprise has done the field good, and I know that the answer is going to be, well, this mix of perspectives is where we get all the good stuff from. So I won't ask you that. I recently had the pleasure of wandering the halls of the Phillips Collection with you.
Yes, that was lovely.
So what is your favorite piece of art?
I'm a big fan of pointillism. And probably my favorite piece of art is the Seurat painting on Le Grand Jatte. It's a fairly technical basis that led me to fall in love with this. Pointillism is the style of art where the artist puts lots of little colored dots down, and if you look up close, it looks like a lot of little dots, and if you step back, it starts looking like a fairly nuanced color.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about it, that's also what systems are like. You have to build all these little pieces, and you have to look at them up close and convince yourself that the piece is going to do the right thing by looking at it up close in a much, much broader context. And dots on a picture have very simple interfaces, and instructions or routines in a system have very subtle and probably far-reaching interfaces. But that connection always really inspired me, and this wonderful Sondheim musical about Seurat has really been a favorite of mine for a long time.
Very nice. Well, thanks for your time today, Fred. This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by InformIT. The July-August 2009 issue of IEEE S&P includes articles on CAPTCHA security, disk and tape disposal, and privacy-aware role-based access control. Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.